Ink and Paint wishes to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded and edited. It is a great privilege to be able to tell stories on this land, which has a tradition of storytelling stretching back over 10,000 years. We also wish to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands from all over the world where our guests record from. We pay our respects to all elders past, present, and emerging, and to our First Nations listeners. Hello and welcome to Ink and Paint, a podcast journey through the Disney animated classics. My name is Daniel Lamon. I'm a writer for the film website Switch, as well as a theatre director and a massive Disney fanatic. And welcome to our very first episode. We'll be exploring, one by one, the films in the official Disney animated canon and talking about their artistic, historical, and social context, where they come from, their impact, and how they sit with us now. It's the grand story of Walt Disney, of Walt Disney Animation, and of animation itself. Every episode, I'll be joined by a special guest. They won't only be film and animation enthusiasts, though. We'll be speaking to people from all over the arts, as well as from other fields outside the arts, and wherever possible, from guests who represent the many diverse cultures depicted, accurately or inaccurately, throughout the Disney canon. It's been a pet project of mine to do this, to go through the films in chronological order and see the wider story of Walt Disney Animation, and I'm looking forward to sharing that journey with you here on Ink and Paint, and putting all the nerdy crap that I've gathered in my head over many decades to some good use. A bit of housekeeping before we begin, though. I'll be working from the official animated classics list released by Disney for US audiences, with a few bonus films along the way. That means, though, no Pixar, no direct-to-video sequels, and no remakes. All of the films we'll be discussing, apart from one short and one feature, can be found on Disney+, so it's relatively easy for you to follow along. If everything goes to plan, Disney will release their 60th animated film at the end of 2021, so we've got a lot of films to talk about. Joining me on this two-part episode is our very first guest, Nicholas Koller. He's a film director and producer and runs the Melbourne-based production company Late Night Films. He's worked on a number of acclaimed short films and music videos and winning many awards and playing in festivals all over the world. Nick, welcome to Ink and Paint.
Hello, mate. Thank you for having me on for the first episode. This is very exciting.
We're not recording the first episode in the most perfect of circumstances. Currently, we are in the middle of a pandemic and we are not in the same place, but it seemed like as good a time as any to get it started.
What a way to self-isolate, am I right?
Yes. So tell us a bit more about the kind of work that you create, Nick. So you've worked a lot on short films and music videos. Describe your work for listeners who don't know it.
Right. So I started out as an actor when I was just a little kid. I did a lot of kids' television and stuff like that back in the days of Blue Heelers and Neighbours and shows like that. And since then went to film school and met a guy called Chris Hocking, who is now my my co-producer and a guy who I own Late Night Films with. And basically we started out when we left uni just shooting as much as we could, as often as we could, and basically learning by doing, which isn't, I don't think, it happens a bit more now, but most of the time people get out of uni and kind of want to go straight into industry, so they we'll go and get jobs as runners or ADs and sort of work their way up. Whereas we decided we wanted to make stuff. So we kind of committed to making mostly shorts early on and then music videos. And since then, we've branched into more long form stuff. So
what prompted you to go from being an actor to being a creative? Like what was the impetus to make that change from being in front of a camera or on a stage to behind a camera?
It came from wanting to, like, enjoying being a part of the whole process. When I was in, I reckon halfway through uni, I was still very much in that, like, I went to film school because I was like, people there will be making films. They'll need actors in their films. What a sick plan.
I mean, it's sound logic.
I know. I thought it was sound logic, right? I was like, I will be in every one of those graduating shorts. Well done, me. Good luck, guys, at drama school. And then in the second year, we were forced to go to the Melbourne International Film Festival, and we were basically given a discounted pass and we were told to go and watch as many films as we could. And That first year I saw 64 films, I think. It was genuinely the first time that I had seen a lot of foreign films, a lot of films that weren't really like American or British or Australian. And it like blew my tiny mind. And I became obsessed with it after that. And every year have like MIFF is one time of year. It's my favorite time of year. I take like 2 weeks off and just go and see as many films as I can. But it opened my mind to what storytelling can be and what you can do with story. And I loved everything about film because I certainly wasn't a kid that grew up, like I sometimes joke with other people that like my story didn't come from like, well, when I was eight, I was shooting Super 8 films in my backyard with nothing but my dog. It genuinely came from a place of like, I really loved acting, and then I just realized how much I actually genuinely just loved cinema and storytelling. And also, I found that I had more control with being able to do that as opposed to acting, which was very much like I was relying on a lot of other things to go right before I could do something. And often you're getting hired for things that like doesn't really interest you. You're hiring and taking jobs because you're like, well, there's nothing else. Whereas as a filmmaker, I can be like, this is something that I really want to explore. So where do I start and how can I make that a reality, and what does that look like?
And some of the work that you've made with late night films and the other work that you've directed and produced outside of the company, a lot of it has had to do with kids, with the stories about children and childhood experiences. What has led you towards those kinds of stories?
I think there's something quite joyful about kids in the sense that they haven't been corrupted yet. And what I mean by that is, as a child, you don't know anything. And so you are willing to go on any journey without a question. Like, you don't question anything. You just go, okay, this is the reality. I'll go with it. So it allows you to do so much in terms of storytelling because they'll just go with whatever. I think a really good example of that at the moment is the kids series Bluey, which is all about, it's made by an Australian company, an Australian animation, which is about a dad and a mum playing with their kids and playing basically make-believe. And it's the perfect summation of like what's so great about kids is that they'll go on whatever journey you tell them to. They're up for anything. So subsequently, that gives you this enormous palette to work with. And I just remember as a kid, they were the things that comforted me. They were the things that like I remember one of my earliest memories is being simultaneously enthralled and terrified of Beetlejuice. I don't know how to articulate it, but it was one of my favorite films as a kid, but I watched it like behind my hands in front of my face because it scared the shit out of me, but I adored it. Like it was just because I was so fascinated by it.
I watch the BBC version of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe from behind the couch every time the White Witch turned up. I couldn't stop watching it.
Yeah, she was terrifying.
Well, actually, this segues nicely into a question that I intend to ask every single one of our guests on this podcast as one of our early questions, which is, what was the first Disney animated film you remember seeing?
Oh, good question. What was the first one that I remember seeing? I reckon, for some reason, the one that sort of sticks strongest in my mind is probably The Little Mermaid, to be honest.
Right. We're around the same age. So yeah, that would have been in the cinemas when we were pretty little.
Yeah, that's one of the earliest memories that I've got of a Disney film. Isn't that a weird one to have as like an early memory?
No, I mean, I think for a lot of people around of our generation, our age, no, it's probably the one that we're going to hear that a lot on this, that The Little Mermaid is a film. Do you remember seeing, was that at the cinema or was it on VHS?
I'm pretty sure it was on VHS because one of the weird things about my background is that my family are not big, like, you know, again, I don't have a story of like, yeah, well, my mum and dad were filmmakers or artists or like they're your average Western suburbs couple. And we didn't really go to the cinema heaps. So I did watch like my favorite thing to do was go to the video store. But yeah, I didn't go to the cinema a lot. So I reckon it was probably on VHS.
And what was your relationship with Disney animated films from then onwards? Like, were they a big part of your childhood or your household? Or were they something that you discovered later? Something you don't have any relationship with?
No, I definitely think that, like, I feel like Disney films were just a for my childhood were just a given. And what I mean by that is that they were the films that you would like, I reckon they just felt like I'd seen all of them. So,
yeah.
You know, in that period of the 90s where they were, you know, with like Mulan and Lion King and Aladdin and Pocahontas, like they all of them I've seen more than two or three times, which is kind of unusual, I guess, but they were definitely part of the fabric of like what I watched. Like they were so they were go-tos really as a kid. And I don't know whether that was something that was like by choice or something that my parents were like, here is some family-friendly fun for you. Because my parents were like, you shouldn't watch The Simpsons because Bart's rude. So I feel like, it was safe. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. We were also, I mean, our generation are pretty lucky in that. When I was a kid was when VHS first started to happen and Disney kind of pushed quite heavily into the VHS market. But it was also the last round of their cinema release schedule. So, like, I remember as a kid seeing Pinocchio and The Jungle Book and Snow White and Peter Pan at the cinema, because it was one of the last times they actually did the rotation of those in the cinema. So, yeah, it makes, like, they kind of were just always there.
And they also seem to, they're also quite prolific too. Like, they seem to be so, like, there were, the catalogue, even at that time in the 90s, was just so big that there were so many films to watch. So you were never kind of without. And I felt like they were churning them out reasonably quickly. I could be wrong about that, but it just felt like there was a new one, like kind of like the Pixar of now, you know, it was just a new one every year.
Yeah, that was their rule. When we'll get into this in 40 films time, but it was actually a policy like that when Michael Eisner took over Disney and Jeffrey Katzenberg was put as the head of animation, they were like, he was like, we need to be getting to the point where we release an animated film every year, which at that point just seemed insurmountable. And particularly with the films we're going to be talking about today, but also the next couple of films, the idea of being able to make these things quickly just seems insurmountable and impossible. And the fact they were re-releasing the classics on VHS and in cinemas meant that it was just kind of around us all the time. Have Disney animated films had any influence on your creative work, like at all? Like, do they come to mind when you're working?
I wouldn't say necessarily in terms of tone or style of the kind of things that I make. Although that said, I definitely think in a weird way, Disney films were my first, like where my first love of musicals kind of came from, because I have like, I am, tone deaf and I can't play instruments and I can't sing, but I really, really have always liked musicals. And it's been like a life goal to like one day direct a musical, even though I would have no idea what to do. And I would probably make it like it'd be more Cats than, say, Moulin Rouge. You know what I'm saying? Like it would be.
Oh, God. Maybe let's not get you to direct a musical then. If it's going to be more Cats, let's stop you from directing a musical.
Totally. I mean, I'm sure I would have made some much better choices than Cats. But that said, I've always really loved musicals. And that definitely 100% came from Disney, came from those early Disney films.
Great. Well, shall we talk about some Disney films then?
Let's do it.
The first film in the Disney canon was Snow White and the Seven Dwarves in 1937, but we're going to start ink and paint by going a bit further back, with five of the most important pre-Snow White short films. In this episode, Nick and I chat about Steamboat Willie from 1928 and The Skeleton Dance in 1929. The company we now know as Walt Disney Animation Studios was founded in Los Angeles on October 16, 1923, by brothers Walt and Roy Disney. Only 21 at the time, Walt Disney was the second youngest of five children to Elias Disney, an entrepreneur with terrible luck, and Flora Cole Disney. When he was 18, Walt moved to Los Angeles in order to break into the movie business, but while he was initially interested in directing live action, the blossoming animation industry caught his eye. He was a sharp-eyed cartoonist working as a commercial advertising artist, and along with colleague and friend, Ub Iwerks, developed first the Laugh-O-Gram series and later the Alice comedies, loosely based on Carol's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland and combining animation and live action. The success of the Alice comedies brought about the Disney Brothers Cartoon Studio in 1923, later renamed Walt Disney Studios in 1926 and Walt Disney Productions in 1929. While business-savvy Roy kept an eye on the company itself, Walt and Ub were in charge of the creative output. Their first major success came in 1927 with the creation of Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, distributed by Winkler Pictures through Universal. But in a devastating blow, Winkler's studio head Charles Mintz, who technically owned the rights to Oswald, set up his own animation studio, took a large number of the Disney animation staff, and began to develop Oswald shorts himself. It was in this moment of desperation that Disney and Iwerks began to develop a new character, a series of circles and ovals that would become the most famous cartoon character in history. And thanks to the recent invention of sound, he would get one hell of a debut. Mickey Mouse is a mischievous deckhand on a steamboat run by Captain Pete. They collect farm animals from Podunk Landing Pier, where they also collect Minnie Mouse, her guitar, and her sheet music. A goat eats the guitar and sheet music, so Mickey and Minnie make music using the ships and the animals. As punishment, Captain Pete makes Mickey peel potatoes. Steamboat Willie was the first Disney animated short with synchronized sound. Though partial synchronization had been achieved in animation before, such as at the Fleischer Brothers Inkwell Studios, this was the first to achieve proper synchronization through the use of a click track, so that the sound and music could work together. It was directed by Walton Ubb, with Ubb animating, and was the commercial debut of both Minnie and Mickey Mouse. Two earlier Mickey shorts had been finished but not released, with Walt wanting to take advantage of the sound technology demonstrated in The Jazz Singer in 1927. The music was arranged by Wilfred Jackson and Burt Lewis and features the songs Steamboat Bill, whistled by Mickey at the beginning, and Turkey in the Straw, a song popularised by minstrelsy in the 19th century. The title is believed to be a reference to Buster Keaton's film Steamboat Bill Jr. as well as the song. Today, Steamboat Willie is perhaps the most famous animated short ever made, mostly as the introduction of the internationally beloved icon, Mickey Mouse. So, we're starting off with the big one, probably the most famous animated short in the history. Had you seen it before, Nick?
I hadn't watched it. I think with all these shorts, I realised as I was watching them, I'd seen all of them, but I hadn't actually... I'd watched them in passing, you know, and I couldn't tell you if I'd watched them from start to finish or if I'd seen bits. What I found, I think one thing I wanted to say about shorts, particularly, and I think it's pretty evident as we go through these, is that shorts are always a great proof of concept. And I think they're used and have always been used as a great proof of concept for directors and their brands and kind of tone and style. So say, for example, with like Christopher Nolan, if you watch Doodlebug, one of his early shorts, it's very clearly Christopher Nolan. Same with like Taika Waititi's Two Cars, One Night, and like all directors really. So I found watching these again and the progression as we go through them, it's the tone and style of what Disney would become is very, very clear early on, which is really, really interesting. Particularly with the setup of the focus being on music and not just like how they use music, but also the playing of music as well.
Yes. Well, I guess I was thinking as I was watching it that this was probably one of the first times for an audience they became aware of the concept of sound design as an art form, because I mean, sound had, you know, we had barely been introduced already, and you know, The Jazz Singer is, it's a musical moment, but everything is being captured live on the set because they don't like, or it's associated with the real world. With Steamboat Willie, all of the sounds you're seeing have to be artificially created. So in a way, even though this is the first introduction of Mickey Mouse and it's a style that would become like, it's kind of like the Rosetta Stone of what Disney animation is, it's actually the sound that becomes the most prominent and important thing in it, because it's the sound that's driving the story more so necessarily than the visuals. And it must have been a real, like, you know, there's lots of, I've got a quote from Variety that I'll read in a bit of their response to the film, but it would have been a real shock for an audience to see a sound design that intricate.
Interestingly, too, there's a lot of it. Like, it's not like there's just a few bits of sound. Like, I feel like, again, a common theme throughout all these shorts is that every time there's a progression, it's not just kind of like dipping their toe in the water. It's like he really went, or they, I should say, really went for it in terms of like, well, here's a new technology. Let's go for it and see what happens.
Because, I mean, The Jazz Singer is the year before. Like, and that's maybe, I think, 10 minutes of sound. And like, yeah, as you were saying, like with all of the shorts that we've chosen for this episode, they all are giant leaps forward, and they're not like tentative steps. The fact that, you know, this is 7-8 minutes long, and you know, you would assume that, you know, sound, like, you know, synchronized sound, you could just kind of, you know, start really carefully and be really, you know, tentative in the approach. But yeah, it's almost wall to wall, and none of it is it's all very complex. It's all complex interactions between an object, between multiple objects making, acting in a symphonic way. They choose not to have dialogue, though there's kind of like gibberish in it as well. It's for a proof of concept of what can synchronized sound do in an animated context, it's kind of jumping right into the deep end.
And just on that, it's interesting that a lot of very, very successful filmmakers, and not all of them, obviously, but I'm talking about the ones that your James Camerons and Peter Jacksons of the world, despite what you think about their work, is that there's kind of an equal love of not only, it's a sense of, I want to tell this story, but I can't do it, so I will try and create what I need to be able to do it. And what's really cool about that is that they're the ones that mean that, things progress really quickly, and that, all of these things that we take for granted as filmmakers now are created because trailblazers right at the beginning were kind of like, well, shit, we can use sound in a thing, so let's try and see how far we can push that, rather than just kind of dipping their toe in the water, like I was saying before. One note that I made, it's interesting that you can see the influence of early silent films, particularly the kind of slapstick comedy sort of tone in these as well, which were obviously really super prevalent, your Buster Keatons and Charlie Chaplins around the same time.
Well, it's kind of positioning Mickey Mouse as kind of their equal. It's the other thing that's really exciting about looking at a film like Steamboat Willie is that we now have such a really strong idea about who Mickey Mouse is as a figure. And like you were saying before, that you can see, the starts of where the concept of Disney animation comes from. This is really you can see the idea of Mickey being, a rascal, being really playful, working against authority. All the aspects that we now associate with Mickey are all right there in this 7 minutes, this very first 7 minutes of being introduced to him. And it does, you feel like you're watching someone, a character who is playing within the same world as Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin and Harold Lloyd and that kind of stuff, which must have been a really exciting thing for an audience to see, was to see a character that misbehaves.
Yeah, and it's also, too, if you think about what, maybe not so much now, but what we knew as cartoons in our childhood, so even all the Warner Brothers cartoons and stuff like that, the style feels very heavily borrowed, or not so much borrowed, but Disney, the early Disney stuff definitely set a tone of what animation would become in later years.
And just the way, there's so many, it's kind of wonderfully violent. There was actually, one thing I found in researching the film was it actually got into a little bit of trouble for depictions of animal cruelty. So about 30 seconds of it had been, over at some point in its history, about 30 seconds of it was cut because of the extreme ways in which when Minnie and Mickey are using the animals to, play turkey in the straw. There's the moment where Mickey grabs the cat and pulls the cat's tail and starts using that, almost using it as a violin. And the extreme ways in which bodies and objects can be pulled and stretched. It's the kind of squash and stretch concept that they were developing with animation. But it's some of the moments, it's kind of a bit shocking the way that, how violently they do that, but the glee with which they do it, which is kind of an extension of the danger that Chaplin or Keaton or Lloyd would put themselves in. You can imagine that if, Harold Lloyd hanging off the clock in Safety Last, I think, if he could be stretching his arm to elongate the gag, he would. It's kind of in animation, it's almost like animation is taking the concepts of those great slapsticks artists and extending them even further than they would be possible within reality.
Well, on that idea, the interesting thing about animation is that basically, so whenever we've dipped our toe in animation and done a little bit of animation in the past, but always when it comes to sketching out a story, when you're talking about live action as opposed to animation, it always comes back to, in animation, you can get away with things that you can't get away with in live action because it's heightened and because there's an expectation that it will be heightened. So what I find interesting about the animal cruelty thing is that, and I know it, these are in the early days of animation, but what's really interesting about that is that I feel like that would be the perfect place to do stuff like that because you can get away with it because people know that it's made up. Whereas in live action, so we've developed a lot of live action kids stuff, a lot of comments that you get back are, oh, we can't do that because that's considered what's called imitable behavior. So that's considered something that a kid might try. So whereas in animation, it doesn't matter because it's highly unlikely that they'll try it because it's they know that it's made up because they're looking at an animated dog or an animated mouse or whatever that may be. So I find that really, really interesting because you're right. It does. I hadn't even thought about it being even mildly cruel to animals because I was like, oh, it's an animation. So that just didn't register for me. But then when I read it in your notes and watched it back, I was like, okay, no, I can see that. They are pretty brutal with the animals.
And there's also some just like one of the images, it was one of my favorite images in it, but one that I remember watching it and finding really unsettling was the cow when they're bringing the cow onto the steamboat. And the fact the cow is so thin that when Mickey puts the strap around it to lift it up with the crane, he can't because the cow's so thin. And so he just goes over, gets a big pile of hay. The cow eats it and the cow's the right size again and lifts it up. Like, the manipulation of physical form in this is really bizarre in a 2020 context and really exciting because, I mean, there's also, like, this is the early days where, you know, animation is very much a new art form. It's a few decades old, but, you know, the commercialization of it is still relatively new. They're still trying to work out what the rules of it are, both in terms of the artistic rules, but also the moral rules. So the aiming for reality is not of interest to this film in a way that now animation is so trying so hard to kind of aim for reality. Like, I remember when I was a teenager, a friend in high school showing me a section from Miyazaki's Castle of Cagliostro and as a point of comparison to Disney and saying, look, doesn't this look more realistic than Beauty and the Beast? I mean, it doesn't, so I don't know what his argument was. But I remember being really confused by that as a statement of going, but that why does animation have to represent reality? And it's great to see in the very early days this sense of, like as you said, the rules don't apply in terms of what you can and can't do in animation. Certainly, in 1928, where you don't have to worry about like censorship and not having to worry about that kind of, like, you know, you have, you know, Captain Pete spits tobacco for a good 30 seconds in it. That's not a thing that you would probably see in an animated film 10 years after that.
Well, I guess that's that it brings up an interesting argument, which I'm not going to get in with you because I know how you feel about it, about the remake a lot of these animated films as live action in this day and age.
Oh, God, we're not even half an hour into this goddamn podcast and someone's bringing up the fucking remakes.
But, no, I'll only touch on it briefly because I know how angry it makes you. But it's interesting that then I think that supports the argument of, like, well, what's the point? Like, the whole reason that these films are animated is because they can get away with stuff and they can create a heightened world, whereas with the advancement of CGI, that's become a thing where filmmakers are now like, well, why don't we make it super real? We're like, well, because it's harder to escape into an alternate world, I think, or escape into the story because you're so focused on it being, like, you know, on like a real lion talking, whereas it's really not having any impact on the actual film itself and you're not changing anything. You're just making it look more real, which seems a bit ridiculous. But let's not get into that because I know you'll hang up on me in the next 5 to 10 minutes.
That's fine. That's fine. I'll forgive you. But I mean, on that point, I mean, it's kind of the thing, like, we're looking at a short, an animated short that is over 90 years old. Like, that's the, a lot of these shorts, we're looking at them, they're edging towards almost a century old, certainly this one. And it doesn't have any sense of, you know, it doesn't aim for reality. It's very it's rough in its animation because, you know, it's the very early days technology. Like, the fact it has synchronized sound is extraordinary for how old it is in itself. And yet, it's really arresting and it's really funny. And you don't ever feel bored watching. Like, I watched it twice, just watched it, then watched it again straight afterwards. And it has aged in its form, but it hasn't aged in its entertainment. It's still incredibly entertaining. What are some of the getting the cow onto the ship is one of my favorite moments. What are some of your favorite little bits from Steamboat Willie?
I think that's one of them. I think launching into the final musical sequence is really fun. I do really like the cow being loaded onto the boat. I think that's super fun. I think the whole thing is kind of great. It's just really sort of light and silly and it's sort of everything that you want from a really fun animated short, I guess. It's kind of super quick and gets like plows through the lack of story, and it's really just like an entertaining kind of musical number in a way.
Yeah, it's like, as a proof of concept and an introduction to not one but two iconic like cultural figures. It kind of just, the fact that it doesn't have a strong narrative, it's very short, gets to the point, kind of works very much to its advantage because you just fall in love with Mickey almost the second he appears. Like even though it's the image of him navigating the steamboat and whistling Steamboat Bill is an image that you would imagine almost every single human being that with the ability to do so knows what that image is. Even though most people will probably never have seen Steamboat Willie. It's amazing how just seeing that image, it still has such an enormous impact. You go, I like this thing, this series of ovals and circles. I don't know what, it doesn't even look like a fucking mouse. Like it, but I instantly fall in love with this thing.
I find it interesting, and obviously, like, it's a, I think you were mentioning in your notes that Walt Disney became interested in animation because it seemed to be a kind of industry that was blossoming. But I do find it really interesting that he wasn't an animator himself.
Well, no, he was a sketch artist, so he worked a lot in commercial art. But I think the fact was that he did, like, a lot of the Laugh-O-Grams he was doing, he was helping iWorks do those. I mean, that's the really interesting thing about looking at the history of Disney animation, is that there are a lot of figures in this story that most people don't know about. Ub Iwerks is kind of the most prominent, I think, because Disney did not direct, apart from the early shorts. Like, there's a point very soon where Disney is not directing the shorts. He's becoming the figurehead of the company and certainly is intrinsic to the story development process. But no, he's not the animator of these films. It's other people. So in a way, he's the director of the company and the concept that he is the captain of the ship. He's like Mickey at the wheel, steering the boat, the steamboat of animation into whatever direction he wants it to go to. He just relies on other people to be able to make the boat work.
Really interesting, because I think that that was a thing that now exists a lot more, in the sense that, to say, for example, look at Blumhouse, right? Like, that is obviously a company, but you know what you're going to get from a Blumhouse film. And he's set up a very successful business model where he has, you know, arguably, I know for sort of film buffs, it's pretty easy to name directors and stuff, but arguably it's the Blumhouse name that you're attracted to when you go and see a film. Or a Blumhouse film. It's less these days, you know, director focused. Or, Pixar's another great example. And it's the same, you know, same with Pixar. I know Pixar, they're a bit more famous in terms of the directors and stuff, but again, it's like, it's setting up a style and a brand that you're not necessarily the director that's in charge, you're more of the curator, in a sense.
Steamboat Willie was released in New York City on November 18, 1928, attached to the film Gang War. It was an enormous success and instantly made Mickey Mouse and his creator a celebrity. On November 21st, Variety wrote, "This one represents a high order of cartoon ingenuity, cleverly combined with sound effects. The union brought forth laughs galore. Giggles came so fast at the Colony Theatre they were stumbling over each other. It's a peach of a synchronization job all the way, bright, snappy, and fitting the situation perfectly." The short was entered into the US National Film Registry in 1998 and has been central to discussions around copyright, almost entering public domain several times. At this stage, Steamboat Willie is due to enter public domain in 2023, but not Mickey Mouse himself. There are also arguments to suggest that due to a misplaced credit, the film has already entered public domain. In 1928, composer Carl Starling pitched an idea to Walt Disney, a marriage of popular music and animation. This idea became the Silly Symphonies, a series of 75 animated musical shorts which ran from 1929 to 1939. The series would become a wild financial and critical success, permeating the popular culture with merchandising, iconic characters, and hit music, as well as acting as a testing ground for new film and animation technologies and winning 7 Academy Awards for Best Animated Short. They would pave the way for the studio's first feature-length animated film, Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, in 1937. And the first of the Silly Symphonies was our next short, The Skeleton Dance. A group of 4 skeletons dance in a cemetery at night, interacting with owls and cats. Once the sun begins to rise, they go back to their graves. The idea was part of Carl Starling's pitch to Disney, who also composed the music for the short. Once again, Walt was the director of the Skeleton Dance, while Ub was the animator, completing the film in 6 weeks. Ub Iwerks is an enormously important figure in the development of Disney animation, but not as publicly well known as his creative partner. A native of Kansas, Missouri, Iwerks met Disney in 1919 in Kansas City, and when they began developing the Laugh-O-Gram series, Iwerks was the chief animator. It was Iwerks who developed the designs for Oswald the Lucky Rabbit and stayed on with Disney after Charles Mintz tempted many of the Disney staff over to his studio. Determined never again to work with a character he did not own, Disney asked Iwerks to develop a new one, which became Mickey Mouse. The first few Mickey Mouse and Silly Symphony cartoons, including Steamboat Willie and The Skeleton Dance, were entirely animated by Iwerks, but unable to cope with Disney's difficult and uncompromising demands, as well as disgruntled by his partner's tendency to accept all the credit, Iwerks and Disney severed their friendship in 1930, and the artist who had essentially laid the groundwork for what became the Disney style left the studio to establish his own. Of the five shorts we're talking about, Skeleton Dance is the only one not available on Disney+, but you can find it on Disney's official YouTube channel. So yeah, Skeleton Dance, had you seen this one before? I ask this because you are about to release a short. Well, by the time this comes out, the short will be out, but a short about a skeleton.
This is very, very true. How fortuitous. This is actually one of the ones I did say before that I thought I'd seen all of them. This is one of the ones that I don't think I had seen. So it was interesting to watch. Now that you mentioned the animal cruelty thing, there is also a lot of animal cruelty going on in here. So a lot of owls getting blown up and whatnot.
It's amazing how very easily animals in this short lose their feathers or fur instantaneously. Like, it's not like the moment where, you know, the skull gets thrown at the owl and all of the feathers disappear, but like the way when the cats first see the skeleton and their fur just leaps off them. It's just like this bizarre recurring motif in Disney animation of this period of animals losing their fur and feathers. Very strange.
It's very bizarre. Also, does the dog early on not look a lot like Pluto?
Oh, yeah, that's true. I don't think Pluto was around yet. I think Pluto's still a little way off, but yeah.
I had to cross-check. I had to, like, do some Googling because it had been a while, but I felt like the idea of what Pluto looked like was burnt into my memory. And yeah, there's some big Pluto vibes going on in this.
Why is it you think that this is one of the few iconic Disney shorts that isn't on Disney+?
That is a good question. I don't know, because it's kind of, there's nothing about it that I don't, that it's quite delightful. Like, it's very silly. Like, I would argue that it's possibly more silly than Steamboat Willie.
Yes.
So I have no idea. It seems like an odd choice to leave this one off.
I agree with, delightful is a really great word to describe it. But I mean, there are some, like the way that the skeletons rearrange their bones, like most of it's kind of funny, but that last moment before, when the sun's coming up, before they jump into the grave, where they've rearranged all of themselves into this like multi-headed long.
I'm sorry, I've called that the human centipede moment. This is the first instance of the human centipede in history was in Skeleton Dance. I watched that and I was like, oh, that's depressing. That's really weird.
But it's like there are moments in Skeleton Dance where it is so much fun to watch, and then there are little things in it where you're like, oh, they're playing with the edges of what's appropriate. Like they're playing with, I mean, it's a constant question with these shorts about who are the audiences aimed for, and because they were talking about, you know, the 1920s, it isn't a safe assumption to say these are all for children. This is really where, like, you have to assume they're for all ages. I mean, that's probably why you have popular music that would have been recognizable to adults in Steamboat Willie. But this kind of edges towards the edge of what you could imagine kids would be able to handle.
That's true. And I do forget we're talking about, what, the late 1920s here, whereas, like,
yes,
if we go forward in time to Little Nick Collar being scared of Beetlejuice, this is probably the equivalent of, you know, 1920s kids being scared of skeletons rearranging their bones into a weird human centipede-like figure.
Though weirdly, mentioning something like Beetlejuice, it feels like the influence of something like the Skeleton Dance feels very prevalent in something like Beetlejuice, because it has, you know, the music, Starling's music is really playful and wicked and witty. And so it plays very much in the gap between the macabre and the joyous. Like it's a lot more fun for the fact that it's playing with potentially frightening images. And it's based on a kind of like a dance macabre concept, you can kind of see like an arc through to something like the Skeleton Dance is not that far removed from something like Beetlejuice. It's fun to be scared of.
Well, yeah, well, I was going to say, there's also something interesting about, and, you know, speaking from having just produced a short with a skeleton in the lead, because skeletons are, I think, by nature considered quite scary and considered like something of horror. Like, you know, often Halloween, people will hang skeletons and whatnot in their yard. So it's something that is supposed to be scary. But when you flip that on its head, so like obviously Tim Burton does it a lot in early Tim Burton stuff. When you flip that on its head and have characters that are kind of lovable and the opposite of what the expectation of what a skeleton is, it's really interesting because it does, like, something that you are considered to be scary is quite adorable. And there's something kind of nice about that, which is like, this is so playful in the way that, like, the skeletons aren't scary in the slightest, but yet it's set in kind of like a dark and dreary cemetery and everything has got these really kind of like dark shades.
In a way, all of the animals are scarier in this short than the skeletons, to the point where the skeletons are scared of the animal. There's such an awareness. You're aware that they know we're here. Like the audience, there is no fourth wall in the film. They're performing for us. Their kind of joy, their joyous dancing is for our entertainment, which just kind of adds to their real sense of charm. And yeah, there is something fun about these gangly, weird, because, you know, we can't function as skeletons. We need all the muscles and sinews and bones. Like watching the skeletons in Jason and the Argonauts, the Harryhausen film. They have the same kind of, you know, quality of kind of like jump, like jiggling and jungling on their feet, which is really endearing.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was banned in Denmark in 1931 for being too macabre. So apparently it did upset some people. And at the end of the review that Variety published in July 1929, the last line of it is, "Don't bring your children."
Don't bring your children. And hold on. Denmark of like Hans Christian Andersen fame.
Fairy tales
kind of messed up.
Yeah. The information I found was it was banned in 1931 for being, quote, too macabre.
How funny. Too depressing.
The obvious comparison I had watching this was the night at Bald Mountain sequence in Fantasia, which is a similar kind of concept of the dead rising from their graves in the middle of the night to have a dance macabre. But while this is really charming and really funny and playful, watching them, you know, take themselves apart and make instruments out of themselves and going into synchronized dancing. And like another thing that I realized is it's a much more sophisticated marriage of synchronized sound and animation than Steamboat Willie. It's trying for something much more complex. But while this is joyous, Night on Bald Mountain is really quite disturbing as a point of comparison. And this is only like 10 years later that they attempt that.
Wait, because what was Fantasia? Was that 40s? 40s, 50s,
yeah, 40s?
Yeah, 1940. Yeah, right.
Favorite moments. Mine were the bits where the skeletons leapt at or through the screen. Like that bit where the skeleton jumps at the screen and you go through its ribcage. Ah. Oh.
Well, it's so interesting because I agree, 100% agree. And before I was going to say, when we're talking about the whole lot, like, you know, animation, live action thing, one thing I really loved about Spielberg and Peter Jackson's Tintin, right, is one of my favorite things about that film is how Spielberg used the animation for transitions from scene to scene. They're really intricate and beautiful, like works of art. They're so fantastic. And it was so interesting in this that was one thing that I was like, oh, what a fantastic transition. That's such a cool thing that is used a lot now in films, but like in the early days, that's such an interesting thing to have been featured in an interesting technique to have been featured in a short in 1929. It's really cool.
And it kind of feels, in a way, this, but by comparison to Steamboat Willie, it's kind of like with this short, you can sense Disney and Iwerks finding what the language of storytelling in an animated form can be, because you have transitions. I mean, in Steamboat Willie, it's just you cut from one moment to the next. Here it's going, what are the ways, if we can do anything, how can we move from moment to moment in a way that's going to be interesting and dynamic and exciting and keep the story rolling? I mean, there's even less of a story in this than Steamboat Willie, but it always has this great sense of forward motion. And I think you're completely right. The fact that there's an awareness of how to move from moment to moment in an artistically thrilling way really adds to this, to the sense of movement. It's great.
Well, I think that that's the thing about, like, the best filmmakers in the world are ones that try things, and they might not always work, but I always have so much love for, even if it doesn't work, for people that try things and that's why someone like Edgar Wright's so interesting, is because he tries stuff that might not always work, but you're like, oh, there's such an interesting thing that I've never seen before. There's so many directors that do it, but and I guess that's developing their own style, but the thing that people forget when they're making films is that regardless of where, you know, what's been developed before, there are no rules. Like, you can do anything you like, and the best work is always the one that takes those rules and either bends them or breaks them or tries things that, again, might not always work, but might create something fascinating and interesting. And particularly in a time where, you know, we're seeing a lot of the same things over and over again. I don't think it's any surprise that a film like Parasite was everybody's favorite film last year, because it was so interesting and weird and wonderful. And he plays with genre and tone so fantastically. But it's, you know, we're coming off the back of having a very long period of having the same stuff that's getting churned out. So that idea of play and trying things and you know, treating it like there are no rules is really cool.
And testing your audience to see what they can take. I mean, in, you know, 1929, there does feel there's something quite quietly radical about the idea of using the macabre as a comedy. Because, I mean, Skeleton Dance is essentially a comedy. It's a comic skit. And you're using a context like skeletons dancing in a graveyard at night. We're talking about the dead. We're talking about mortality. But we're doing it in a way that's kind of joyous. And it's a marriage of two tones, like a visual tone and a musical tone that shouldn't necessarily work. And I think I would be intrigued to know whether there is anything else like this pre-Skeleton Dance. Certainly they play with similar ideas later on in the rest of the Silly Symphonies, and certainly with the feature films. But yeah, there's something kind of like, it feels like they're pushing in what kind of story they can be telling, what kind of images they can put onto a screen into a new direction, as well as the technological advancements in it. On the next episode of Ink and Paint.
Assuming you're a huge fan of the Emma Watson live action remake.
It's a war crime. That film is a war crime. Nick and I continue with the Silly Symphonies, with the Oscar-winning shorts Flowers and Trees, Three Little Pigs and The Old Mill. A big thanks again to Nicholas Koller for joining me on this, our very first episode. You can find more about his company, Late Night Films, at www.latenightfilms.com, as well as Facebook, Twitter, and Vimeo. Be sure to check out the show notes on this episode at inkandpaint.com.au for more information about the early days of Walt Disney Animation and the shorts we've discussed, including links to the shorts themselves. Since we've just started off with this new podcasting adventure, we'd love to hear what you thought of our first episode. Hit us up with your comments, questions, and even memories of your favourite Disney films, and we'll be sure to share them on our upcoming episodes. You can email Daniel at inkandpaint.com.au or find me on Twitter at Daniel Lamon. We'll be releasing new episodes every fortnight, so if you enjoyed the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favourite podcasting platform, and don't forget to tell your friends. Ink and Paint was created, hosted, and written by myself, Daniel Lamon, and produced and edited by Alex Amster. Music is composed by Sam Porter. The show artwork is designed by Nicholas Piranakis, with episode illustrations by Lily Meek, and the podcast is released through Switch, maketheswitch.com.au. Join in next time on Ink and Paint to continue our journey through the Disney animated classics.